It's 2030. Are the majority of summer blockbuster films entirely computer generated? Marina Danilevsky is a senior research scientist. Marina, welcome back. What's your prediction?
Summer blockbuster films, maybe. Submissions to Cannes, no.
Okay. Cool. Sounds great. Abraham Daniels is a senior technical product manager for Granite. Abraham, welcome back. We haven't seen you in a while. Welcome back to the show. What's your prediction?
I really, really hope not. I'm hoping that Tarantino still makes movies and he only does films. So cross my fingers.
Keeping it strong. And Gabe Goodhart is chief architect, AI open innovation. Gabe, welcome back. Movies in 2030, what do you think?
I only watch animated movies with my kids at this point. So yes, those ones are computer generated. My hope is that some of the ones that I don't get to watch are at least have somebody wearing a bodysuit behind them.
All right. All that and more on today's Mixture of Experts. I'm Tim Huang, and welcome to Mixture of Experts. Each week, MOE brings together the sharpest team of researchers, engineers, and product leaders that you'll find anywhere in podcasting to discuss and debate the biggest news in artificial intelligence. As always, we have a lot to talk about. We've got the end of Stack Overflow. We're going to talk a little bit about a new project called LLMD, a new release from Microsoft called NLWeb. But first, I want to start by talking about Google I.O. So Google I.O., if you don't know, is Google's annual developer conference. It happened this week, and there was a raft of announcements. To be expected, it was basically AI, AI, AI. I don't know if you've seen the supercut of Sundar Pichai, the CEO of Google, just saying AI on a previous I.O., but this year's I.O. was actually no exception. Perhaps one of the biggest announcements that I want to get into first with the panelists is the announcement of a $250 AI Ultra plan, which now kind of joins the Anthropic plan and the OpenAI plan in terms of these like very highly priced subscriptions. And then with that, the launch of VO3, which is their video generation model. And a lot of people have been having a lot of chatter about it. It's able to generate kind of text to video, and then interestingly can do audio now as well. Abraham, maybe we'll start with you. You had a little bit of skepticism, or you hoped in the very least, you know, that Hollywood would stay true to its roots and keep doing, you know, movies with real people. Curious about this, though. I mean, this technology seems really good, and it feels like if anything is in the crosshairs, it's basically movie production.
So in terms of the movie production aspect of it, yeah, I'm not super convinced. Just a couple reasons. One, in terms of the actual length of video you can generate, it may be high quality, but in terms of actually being able to, you know, cobble together an hour and a half movie via, you know, a very specific prompt, like, I don't buy that quite yet. But I do think it'll be, you know, really cool in terms of adding to special effects or being able to enhance certain, you know, scenes or features within movies that I think it can really play a part in. In terms of the price tag for the actual, you know, using their models, I think it's kind of interesting given, you know, you've got this, you know, open source community that's really starting to, you know, catch wind in terms of a lot of the major developers kind of, you know, loading their models into, you know, Apache 2 MIT licensing. So I'm curious to see how that actually pans out. I wish I had more information on how OpenAI was kind of, you know, surfacing with their $200 per month subscription. But, you know, I guess everybody's kind of clawing for dollars right now. It's a tough market to make money in right now in LLM development. So, you know, it's kind of a winner take all.
Yeah, for sure. And Marina, I had kind of an interesting question I was describing very excitedly to my partner last night. I was like, oh, look at this new VO3 thing. And she had this great response, which was like, what is this for? What are you going to use this for? Why would you pay $200 for this per month, or $250 for this per month? Is there really a consumer angle here? Or is this kind of just like a fun toy? Like, it feels like there's a mismatch between how much you would pay for, you know, one of these features, which presumably you think is like one of the features why you'd want to buy their bundle, and I guess what you'd even just use it for on a day-to-day basis.
So putting my economist hat on for a second, I think there's something very nuanced to the fact that you can't really get these things separately. You have to get them in a bundle. So some of them, these features immediately are useful right now, and you could use them right now. Others, you might just be playing around with. But again, to improve these things like VO and whatever, Google needs data. They need data. They're going to get it from you playing around with stuff while actually making immediate use of the things that are more advanced. So yes, to your point, it's a little bit hard to make money right now in LLM space, but also the fact that they're bundling several technologies that are at different degrees of readiness, it's kind of clever. I got to say, because that is that exactly. You're going to bring people in with something that's already working pretty well, and then you're going to be able to that way get already an ecosystem of people. And that's going to work to their advantage.
Yeah, that bootstrapping is really interesting. I think another dynamic, and Gabe, curious if you have any thoughts about kind of like this pricing war that we're seeing now across all these companies is, I guess, in effect, people are going to have to choose one, right? Like, I think is where some of this is going if they want all the features. And so this kind of market for people who are willing to pay significant money on a month-to-month basis for these services almost will end up being a little bit kind of like you have to choose one. And yeah, I don't know, curious about how you think about that.
Yeah, no, I mean, to lean into what Marina said, it's a little bit like cable bundling wars and cable providers, right? Like you've got different companies each competing to be the one with the best bundle of capabilities. And you got to have an anchor show, or in this case, feature that somehow differentiates itself from the pack. And then, you know, you hang all the rest of your shows off of that, and hopefully a couple of them catch fire and, you know, bring in some more eyeballs. But it'll be really interesting to see where this bundling thing sits. And then when/if the equivalent of, you know, the streaming revolution comes around and starts to decompose things into a la carte, whether that's maybe open source models and open source frameworks are the equivalent of, you know, early streaming services that take apart the bundling. But it's all happening at the same time this time rather than, you know, an entrenched industry. So I think it's going to be really interesting to see, you know, how those two sides of the coin shake out. Well, one of those sides of the coin is bitterly fighting with its peers, right? So in the bundling market, in the paid for market, the peers are going to be fighting. And then the open source is going to be the alternative to the whole paradigm, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. And do you want to go into that a little bit more? I mean, I know you spend a lot of time thinking about open here.
Yeah, obviously, I guess in my title, it kind of states my bias here, but...
yeah, that's right. I mean, like, ultimately, you think that open's going to win, but is this sort of like the exhaust vent on the Death Star, like open source is going to be the thing that really kind
no,
of...
I think there are roles to be played for put it together yourself. And I think, you know, we've seen this in development for a long time. This is not new to AI. I think back to early Visual Studio days where you had to pay for expensive subscriptions or at least expensive boxes of software with a CD inside to install a good IDE on your computer. And then, you know, eventually things either caught up or surpassed in open source. And we found that the tools themselves were not what people wanted to pay for. So I think software development in general has always sort of been a game of searching for where there is value that is worth paying for. And a lot of times the things that initially seem like extremely high value propositions eventually migrate to a commodity that people expect to be able to get for free. And then the value moves somewhere else. So I think in our space, I'll win the Mixture of Experts game. I think we're going to see that shifting in the agent's direction. I think we'll start to see probably vendored proprietary agents that people are willing to pay for that gets you a higher entry point into the stack. And then the model itself is going to be a bit more commodity. But that's my prognosis going forward.
Yeah. And I really do want to talk about, I mean, that was the kind of second set of things coming out of I/O that obviously they announced a lot of things. But the other big thing was, well, we now really want search to be more agentic. You know, Gemini is going to have agent mode that you can turn on. And I guess, Abraham, I'm curious about your response to that is like, you know, maybe to put a finer point on it, is like, is search the killer, you know, agent capability? Like, I think that's kind of what was being offered by Google here is to say, look, we do search really well. If we can do that in a more agentic way, then that's the killer in the agent space. But I think you also see a lot of other companies kind of competing for this. So kind of curious what you think.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great question. I'm just kind of thinking about, you know, all the organizations that kind of have search out of either like native as part of their agent capabilities, you know, with ChatGPT and Perplexity AI, where it really is not something that's net new with respect to agent capabilities. I think it's kind of going to be table stakes where at the base minimum, you have to be able to support search as part of your agent framework. So it may not necessarily be something that is, you know, bleeding edge. But I think it's really like in order to be able to come to the table and, you know, be a player as part of the agentic framework, search has to be one of the baseline, you know, capabilities that you can support. And on top of that, you know, you can kind of decide what makes the most sense for your user base. But I think it really search is basically like a starting point that if you can't support that at the bare minimum, then, you know, I think it just kind of raises some flags.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Marina, I know you hate this kind of question, but I'm going to ask it to you anyways. Is Google suddenly kind of catching up in this race? I know the mood of the conversation, you know, last year was like, oh, they've fallen terribly behind. Like, one of the things I love about AI is like, anyone who is up will be down in a few months. Anyone who is down will be up in a few months. It, again, like, kind of is like, I don't know, Google's suddenly like back on the board again. And so I'm curious about, like, in the kind of battle for market share for this whole scope of tools, like, how, what should we take from I.O.? Is like I.O. kind of a sign of strength from Google, or do you feel like they're still not quite getting it?
I think what's interesting with Google, actually, is how much they're leaning into multimodality. Like, 2/3 of their announcements are about something that has to do with modalities besides text. If you go and look, like, we touched on video, but look at all the stuff that they're doing with Project Astra and with the fact that you're going to be able to search with what's on your camera and all these other things. So I think that Google's definitely in a better position this year than they were last year. But again, compare public perception with what's probably actually going on under the hood. They're doing a pretty good job of saying, oh, don't worry, guys, we still have things going on. But if even after all the talk we're doing right now, everybody's still using Google to search, whether you're in AI mode or not AI mode. And so they're continuing to get the data. And, you know, this is like my favorite topic ever. So they're still going to continue to be pretty ahead in data on which to train any kind of new models. So you're not just having people only interact with ChatGPT. You're having people interact with Google generally. It's a rich thing. And I think there they continue to have an advantage.
So piggybacking on that, this is actually a great segue to our next segment. I want to talk a little bit about Stack Overflow, which, if as many of you may know, is a much-loved forum for technical questions and answers. Founded in 2008, has become really like a pillar of being a technical person online. And the bad news is that the website is dying. Traffic has been dropping, and has been dropping in particular, arguably, because of AI. Whereas in the past, you would have to go to this website to kind of look up the answer to your question on a coding issue. A lot of that's being replaced now by autocomplete, right? Code generation. So I want to talk a little bit about like what that means and what it means for traffic on the web as a whole. And so I guess maybe, Marina, to kind of like give you kind of a concrete question, it's like, do you buy that sort of AI is killing Stack Overflow? And if so, you know, does it pose a danger to like even bigger places like Google?
So the Stack Overflow story does make me sad because that is, it's. I think that we've all used it to a quite a decent amount of degree, and it's really hard to not realize that you can't replace human expertise in these kind of more nuanced questions with just what got auto-generated, which means, once again, regression towards the mean, regression towards homogeneous answers. But what's really terrifying is that, like, look, software always, engineering, it moves really, 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 really quickly. Things are out of date immediately. You need more people asking about what is the newest thing, what is the latest thing. If everyone's asking Cursor and Cursor fixes it and you say, oh yeah, great, that was good. Who's got all that fresh data? Now only Cursor has it, or whoever it is that you're using. So the market share ends up being really important here. So something that I would wish for people to do is to put AI to good work and say, hey, I accepted that answer you just gave me. Why don't you make an anonymized version of my code and post it on the internet? And now we keep Stack Overflow going so that other people can still have this data, can still use this data, keep it, you know, really frictionless way going as a repository of knowledge. There's often more than one answer to these kind of questions. Like, you really want to continue to have these kind of barriers broken down. I understand ease. I understand access. I understand it's right there and it's nice to you and it doesn't have the moderators telling you, this has been answered before, why are you dumb? Sure. But it's short-term gains for a real long-term loss. And so I really hope that we can not fall down that hole.
That's right. And I don't know. I mean, I also like the angry mods. Like, I feel like that's a key part of the experience, is to feel the burn of someone just being very angry about your question. Gabe, so I think, I mean, Marina's describing something which I think is like potentially really important, right? Which is like, well, there are ways of architecting AI systems so they can feed back into a human system, right? But I think here, you know, I guess a cynic would say, well, someone like Cursor has no interest in doing that at all, right? And I guess I'm kind of curious if you feel like how we can change that, right? Like, if we feel like this is a good approach, like, what do we do?
It's interesting. I had exactly the same sort of paradigm idea in my head when I read about the demise of Stack Overflow, which is that I think right now, you know, I think we talked in the last episode I was on about the state of Wikipedia transitioning to bot scraping. And I think, you know, even some of the ones we're going to touch later on in the episode are all about how does the content on the internet transition to an AI first world where the primary consumer is AI. And I think in this case, from a purely consumption standpoint, yeah, it's great. Like, I don't need to spend time searching. I can just get the code snippet directly into my editor. Or worst case, a concise version with, you know, no need to scroll through the comments to actually get, you know, a very clear representation of what I want in a chat context or something like that. So from a user perspective, there's a clear win here, which makes it in some ways a no-brainer that this is going to happen. Like, I don't think we can stop it with that convenience. But I think it's a one-way street right now, right? I was actually talking with someone who used to run a food blog, and essentially her traffic is dead now because everyone just asks ChatGPT for the recipes. And I think we're seeing this sort of the state is all the data is going into the models. I think to some degree, like we talked about with Wikipedia, the state of affairs is still valid for recency and for RAG type of use cases. But it's really changing the shape of who's going to use the data. And I think we'll probably see the shape of the data creation changing. And what I would love to see is exactly what you proposed, Marina, is that this kind of a collaborative effort where when an AI usage performs well, that performed well content then somehow somewhere gets shared. And I think, you know, there's a lot of... You said, you know, someone like Cursor has no interest in that. And I think they probably don't have interest in necessarily sharing it publicly. But I bet that they might have interest in trying to become the new Stack Overflow, where they actually have the ability to subscribe to shared answers. And then if you subscribe to shared answers, you can get, you know, well thought out results, conversations had by other experts with their AI bots accessible in your experience, right? So there's probably a play to be made there for a vendored solution, and then hopefully a open solution that comes along and does a similar thing, but with an actual, you know, fully open ecosystem. That could look something like an agent running client side. You know, I know, for example, the Continue team keeps all of their code open source for the client side. So you could imagine a plugin there that actually hosts this in some kind of a neutral vendor, third-party type of space, right? So I think, you know, just like we're seeing with vendored AI versus open AI, open source AI, we'll probably see something similar, hopefully, emerge around, you know, vendored AI sharing, AI content sharing versus open AI content sharing.
Yeah, no, I think that's great. And I think one of the things is, I think the comparison to the recipe website is so interesting, because one thing I find particularly perverse about this is like how a bunch of sites had to construct themselves in a particular way to be sustainable, right? So like the classic thing with the recipe site is like, it's got the long narrative thing and all of these ads. And, you know, the reason you're doing that is you're trying to make a living being a recipe blogger, and like you need to increase time on site and you want to increase engagement. And, but like, it's exactly that kind of stuff that has made them very vulnerable to say a chatbot where you just get the recipe. And so there's kind of this weird cycle of the economics where, you know, all the decisions you made early on are now making, you know, your industry like kind of particularly vulnerable to what's happening.
Exactly. I think there's going to be a shift in creating content that both appears well for AI, so the SEO for AI type of experience, and then also creating content that hopefully can be monetized through AI so that the content creators, the experts in whatever field it is, whether it's experts on Stack Overflow or chefs, can actually make a living here or actually have value placed on their contribution.
Tim, that was my comment, I don't know how many episodes ago. Do you remember SEO is going to be deeply affected by all this?
The bot SEO. You're ahead of the game.
There we go.
Abraham, can I play like tech bro jerk for a bit, right? Like, I feel like there's one argument, which is, look, these models are getting so good at coding that in a few years, why do we even need Stack Overflow anymore, right? Like, we're past the world of Stack Overflow. Code gen is going to just be able to happen in the future. And so, like, it's very sad, you know, but I guess the tech bro view is like, isn't the technology making stuff like Stack Overflow kind of obsolete? Do you buy that?
Well, yes and no. I think there's kind of two sides to it. Like, when the read the article that you shared, if you notice from the peak of COVID to, you know, the introduction of ChatGPT, it's a pretty big drop. And obviously GPT kind of accelerated the decline of overflow traction, more traffic, but I think it was already something that was in progress. And kind of digging a little bit deeper, I saw that, you know, a lot of people moving from Stack Overflow were going to Discord channels to be able to have conversations or WhatsApp groups. So I think it really signaled that it wasn't necessarily the immediacy that ChatGPT could provide, but more so like a dialogue that you can have in terms of navigating the problem, as opposed to, you know, posting a problem, having a solution at certain points in time being answered, and then, you know, if you had another question to follow up on, there was an issue with just, you know, being able to have time to value in terms of using Overflow. So I think it's less of a, you know, LLMs are going to, you know, who cares? You know, LLMs are going to, you know, remove the need for anything like this. And I think it's, how do we find ways to be able to have, you know, developers or software engineers have more natural engagement when they're trying to navigate a problem? I think it's less about, you know, being able to code. Again, as I'm not an engineer, so I say this lightly, but the being able to code is being democratized relatively quickly. I think it's actually having understanding the strategy behind what you're actually coding that I think is a lot more valuable right now. And that takes a dialogue between yourself and whether it's an LLM or another individual in your space. And I think that's going to be a really key driver for whatever becomes the next, you know, catalyst or focal point for how do we, you know, have a forum for these kind of conversations. So, from a tech bro perspective, I get it. Yes, it just makes it easier. But then from an actual, you know, user perspective, I think it's more about, I want to be able to engage with somebody as I'm, you know, driving these projects.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And I think that there is something there around kind of like, you know, again, like with all the jokes aside on Stack Overflow being kind of occasionally sort of an unfriendly place, like actually like part of like the idea is that you're like kind of communicating with others and solving a problem. And like that there may be some value that we are losing actually in that transition, I think is sort of interesting. I guess the future may be that you're like arguing with your code gen tool on a particular implementation.
Who knows? Yeah.
I mean, the code gen tool is like, did you read the documentation? Jeez. I'm going to move us on to our next topic. Project launched with a number of collaborators from a couple different companies, open source project called LLMD. And I want to start the segment just by reading the description of LLMD. So LLMD, quote, is a Kubernetes native distributed inference serving stack, a well-lit path for anyone to serve large language models at scale with the fastest time to value and competitive performance per dollar for most models across most hardware accelerators, unquote. Gabe, what is this? What does it do? If you don't know anything about Kubernetes, or you don't know anything about distributed inference, like what is this? Why should we care?
Yeah. Okay. So going back to something I said earlier, you know, I do believe that we're going to approach a space where the models themselves are commoditized, and individual models have some strengths over other models. But ultimately, the model you choose is going to have a lot to do with the ecosystem you can choose it with. And if you are a model provider, the thing that makes you attractive is your price tag. And the thing that drives your price tag is the ratio of performance to dollars. And so there's a really big divide between, you know, sort of the open source developer tinkerers that want to be able to load models on their laptop or connect to an API service and run occasional queries. I'm not worried about rate limiting and throughput because I'm just dabbling. I'm just messing around here. And the people who are actually running the models, they really, really care that all of the GPUs that they spent millions of dollars to buy are actually getting used all the time. I thought one of the things that the technical article about LLMD spelled out really well is that traffic for LLMs is very different than the assumptions that a lot of the internet is based on, right? So the internet is based on the assumption that most requests are roughly the same shape and size. You know, sure, you sometimes download big files, but by and large, you've got small requests with small sizes. And so you can just do pretty naive, like, spray them around to a bunch of horizontal replicas of your website, and your website's the same no matter which server you hit. And cool, great, problem solved. Round robin load balancing for the win. But LLMs are very, very different, right? And we've talked about different use cases for LLMs, whether it's a huge amount of context for RAG type of scenarios or a huge amount of output for thinking type of scenarios. They all look and behave differently. And another hugely important part is prefix caching, right? So to get briefly technical here, you know, all of these models are autoregressive, which means they compute up to a certain point in the token sequence, and then they compute the next one. And the math for the next one is based on all of the math that was computed for the previous one. And this is great if you have one instance of your server running, right? Because you've already got all that math pre-computed. It's just sitting there in memory. You can just do whatever the little delta is to get the next token. But if you happen to somehow land on a different server that has not pre-computed all of that, you got to go back to the beginning and start over again. And that's a really wasteful operation. So the thing that the LLMD team has really, really focused on is the routing of requests to make sure you're maximally taking advantage of all of the stuff that's already in memory, those common prefixes, and then also maximally taking advantage of, you know, saturating those GPUs based on the shape and the expected output length of the requests, which I think, you know, is really technical and nitty gritty in the details. But what it's ultimately going to do is mean that for providers of LLMs, and this is not just hyperscalers, to be clear, right? Hyperscalers are going to build their own stacks. This is targeted at enterprises that have constrained environments where they want to approve and manage and run their own models. This is going to give those enterprises the ability to actually run models that fit their business needs at a cost that is actually approachable to, you know, adopt AI inside their space, right? So that's the real target of a tool like this.
Yeah, for sure. And Marina, I guess one question that I think worth asking is, you know, like Gabe was saying, right, the hyperscalers are going to do this in-house. But what's being described here, I mean, this is a lot of work, right? To like get all of the routing to be optimized to maximize GPU usage. And the end result is that you save people a lot of money, right? Ultimately. Why is this getting released in an open way, right? I think is like another set of questions. Like, what's the open source play here? Because this would seem like the kind of thing that you'd want to keep in-house, secret, proprietary.
I mean, the scale at which they would like this to work, you can't keep it in-house. This is almost like having to refigure out how you want to do work in the way that when we realized how to handle databases more efficiently. You want to have a lot of basic ways of how do you represent data, how do you handle transactions, how do you handle collisions and things of that nature. There was not just one company that was like, nope, we're going to own databases. You can't do it. Not if you actually truly want something that is that widely adopted. So in this case, I'm going to go hit back to what Gabe said before about agents, you know, being a new thing. I don't know what agents means either. Nobody knows what agents mean, but it does mean complexity. And it does mean lots of things having to do lots of actions and take lots of choices. So now we're really getting back into database transactions, but for the Gen AI world. And so this is really interesting and important work to almost have a new set of standards across the board for everyone, no matter what particular agentic flow you are or are not using for your own particular use case. So yeah, that's my perspective on it.
To build on Marina's point, the complexity of LLMD, you know, open sourcing, it really leads to a market, like an opportunity for Red Hat to be able to provide support. So when you talk about from a commercial enterprise, how do you actually make money off of this? It's right in Red Hat's wheelhouse where, you know, you provide a very, you know, you an open source technology gets widely adopted and your commercial strategy is really to be able to provide support for it. So I think given the, you know, the consortium of organizations that are on board from a commercial to a, you know, an educational standpoint, I think that's really the play here in terms of, okay, well, why do you want to open source this? Well, because the complexity of it and the adoption of it will really drive support back to Red Hat.
Yeah, 100%. And I think, you know, again, this business model is also not new. I mean, how many technologies out there do people have as the cornerstone of their business that the, you know, play around with it version of it exists on your laptop and the scale it up to production usage is complex enough that you either need to just hire somebody that has already done it and use it as a service, or you need to hire somebody to help you do it yourself. I think that's exactly the same thing here, right? I mean, it's the reason Kubernetes itself has traction. Kubernetes is open source, but there's not a lot of people probably out there. Well, certainly home labbers might be running their own Kubernetes cluster, but when it comes time to running your business, you're generally going to, you know, buy a cluster from somebody, or if you're, you know, a privacy sensitive or otherwise constrained industry, you're going kind of run it on-prem with either a big team in-house or with support from a company like Red Hat that does this for a living.
Yeah, one of the things I love about this is, and I guess it's true of the AI space in general, is like, you know, the technology itself is like so weird and so cutting edge. And like, you know, people are like, we're building a machine god. And then you're like, actually, but the business model is B2B SaaS. Or like, actually, the business model is like Red Hat. You know, it's just like, it turns out like the way we monetize and build businesses around these technologies is like, in some ways, the same game we've always played, you know, which I think is like very interesting. I'm going to move us on to our last topic. Microsoft did a fun little release that I do want to kind of talk about before we wrap up the episode. It's a project called NL Web. And it's an open project that, and again, I'm doing a lot of quoting this episode, but there's good quotes. So, quote, turn your website into an AI app, allowing users to query the contents of the site by directly using natural language, just like an AI assistant or Copilot. And it additionally comes with a little thing where you can set up your website as a model context protocol server so that agents can interact with your site. And I guess maybe Marina, I'll kick it back to you. This is kind of a fun project because it envisions a version of the internet where like everything is just talking. Like you're just talking to every single website, and indeed websites can talk to one another in natural language. And it seems to be in some ways a bet that like actually these conversational interfaces become ubiquitous in a way that is almost like a little bit funny. It's just like, oh yeah, I'm going to go have a conversation with Yelp and then I'm going to go over there and have a conversation with, you know, Twitter or whatever. Are we about to see conversational interfaces take over? I know we've debated it a little bit about like just how dominant that paradigm is going to become for interacting with AI. Curious if you kind of buy that as a vision for where the web is going.
I'm going to also quote something from what they wrote, which is every instance is also an MCP server, allowing websites to make their content discoverable and accessible to agents and other participants in the MCP ecosystem. And that was the thing that I caught on to, not the you're talking to your website. It's your website is now something that is going to be discoverable by agents and agentic flows that are going to have one particular protocol to get stuff and information from your website. And that is the
data.
Data, hello. Once again, data and a standard in how to handshake is where I sort of zoned in on. I believe it was sort of intended more in that direction. So like, is it fun to have that kind of a website? Yeah. But I think the deeper thing is not that we want to have a conversational interface with everything. It's we want this to be a way that the applications that you build on top, that again, to search and to scrape and to take actions and whatever, there's a unified protocol. That was my perspective on this.
That's right. And I think that's the direction we could take it. I mean, Abraham, like, MCP, right, could be the new like thing that just becomes standard built into every resource on the web. You know, I guess like curious how you size that up. Like we may be headed in that direction, is that everybody eventually wants to make themselves very indexable, if you will, to agents.
Full transparency, I may not be the best person to ask this question, but just kind of after a few conversations on MCP with some people here in research, you know, there's a couple different protocols out there. If this is a agent play, I mean, I think there's room for, you know, agent to agent or IBM's agent protocol to be able to step in there and, you know, play a factor. I might have to take a step back here and just better understand, you know, from Gabe or one of the team members, you know, do you foresee this as being actually the de facto protocol for agents or for models being used across websites?
Yeah, and I think maybe do a twist on that for Gabe. It's like we were talking a little bit about like the economics of where attention flows and all that. It kind of feels like if that people don't get that right, I don't know. I might just say I'm not making my site easily interactable with agents. Like I don't want them touching my stuff. You know, like I don't want them getting my data. You know,
that's a great yeah. I think you might see one of two things. Like you know, like the equivalent of MCP's robot.txt. Like don't use this for agents. I think that's exactly right. I think this is a attempt to put a stake in the ground about standardizing the transition to an AI first web, right? I think saying that, hey, this is a better user experience. You get a little chat window and now you don't have to go search around through navigations. Like that's genuinely useful. Also, at the same time, you're exposing the same indexability to agents. And it's basically back to the same problem we talked about with Stack Overflow. It makes these things eminently consumable by AI. The question is there any way to give back or to sort of make it a two-directional street, I think? And Abe, to your point about the multiple different protocols out there, I actually see this usage as exactly the right usage for MCP relative to the other protocols that are out there. So I think because this is unidirectional, this is like, it's like an HTTP server, right? You know, you're going to see MCP /// instead of HTTPS //, right? This is going to be like, go grab my information from my site for the sake of an agent rather than for the sake of a web browser. And I think that's actually, to me, that's a very sensible technology direction for exposing content to something, whether that something is a user, or, you know, a user interface, or a agent. But I do think when you start getting the notion of turning a site into an AI app is more nuanced and interesting to me, because that speaks to not just being a content provider, but also being an interactor. And when you start having that site then also want to go take action against, say, other sites, now you start getting into an agent to agent or an agent communication protocol or something that actually has to allow the interaction that came to me, now I'm going to go choose to take some other action. It's that having agency, shall we say, that will make the site, in fact, actually take action and not just sort of respond to queries. I think that's the delta in my head between the different protocol groupings. And MCP makes a lot of sense as sort of a first step to turn a website from a pile of HTML into something that can be directly exposed to a consumer that has AI on the other end, a model.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Presage is like, I think, a really interesting world where there's like the human web that we all interact with, and then there'll be this like agent web that you kind of maybe never really see that's going on below the surface. And that like, you actually may have sites that are like not even human readable, right? They're just like agent protocol.
Yep, absolutely.
Or the other way around, right? Like, I think there's kind of like, yeah.
And to your question at the top of this, to your twist on the top of this, I think it's going to be an economics question, right? Like at some point, we'll either see that there is a reasonable business model where folks creating that content can get some return on their investment, or we won't, at which point, you know, either people will explicitly not expose MCP servers or add obfuscation to the source code of their website so that it is terrible for crawling, right? Like a whole bunch of gorpy extra tags in there that now the models have to learn to ignore.
Yeah, I mean, the rise of like anti-agent technology is also something we're about to see, right? Which is like, just get your agent lost in this maze that it never gets
exactly.
out of.
Exactly. Go send them down some malformed XML and good luck, right? So it'll be really interesting to see, you know, and as a collaborator by nature, I'd love to see something where there actually is a good incentive for folks to make content available to AI and get some return on that. And I think that would make for a great user experience downstream. But as we know, you know, this is going to be the wild west of the internet. Like there will be combativeness and, you know, people looking for the best advantage. So it'll be really interesting to see where that swings.
Yeah, for sure. So Marina, maybe a last thought from you. You know, I always think a little bit about how like HTTP and like open protocols in general are this kind of weird miracle that everybody just agrees to kind of like be interoperable with one another. Are you bullish on MCP becoming like a uniform standard across the board? Because I mean, to what Gabe was saying, you could imagine a world where you say, look, it's going to be the TIM context protocol. And actually only sites that correspond to the TIM context protocol will have agents that will talk to one another. And so it feels like there's a lot of incentive to kind of like break away and create these kind of like more walled garden type experiences. But I don't know, do you think kind of open wins here, or is it anyone's guess?
I mean, to some extent, hard to predict the future. And I agree with how Gabe had described MCP as a protocol. It's not the only protocol out there, right? We've got FTP, we've got all these protocols for sharing different information in different ways. And very often it really does start because a small enough group of people that are really deeply in the middle of it get real annoyed and say, guys, we're just going to agree on something. And because that is a result, they can actually get somewhere. Everybody else says, yeah, okay, great. We're going to adopt this protocol as well. We need these protocols because otherwise you cannot continue to grow. And especially in the world of AI and agents, scale is more important than ever. HTTP, HTTPS, all right, now it's just like serving a website. MCP, I don't know that it's going to be all that useful unless you have enough people adopt it. So you really are going to have ways to drive adoption. I agree with Gabe that everything's an economics question at the end of the day. Are you getting value from it and are you going to contribute or not? There's a lot of security questions here. Again, if you're going to go and talk to a different website, are you going to come back with like poison pill actions? to take on your own website. This all gets a little terrifying pretty quickly. But I think that, yes, it is going to, either this or a version of this is going to have to be adopted, because you can't have proper scaling in the agentic world without the infrastructure, the tubes underneath it. So yeah, we're going to have some version of this, absolutely.
Well, and I think the flip side of that too is, if you look at browser technology, browsers are really good at handling really bad output, right?
Like, yeah, they have to be.
It's not like, yeah, we're finally at a space where there probably is some, you know, coalescence around, you know, the actual source code of web pages that gets served up to the browser so they can render it. But like, man, handling malformed XML, you know,
took some time.
PHP, JavaScript, every other piece of web technology that's ever been thought of as a way to revolutionize, you know, what a server is hosting that gets eventually rendered in your browser. So it's a two-sided coin. Like, one, there's some coalescence on the creator side. And then two, there's got to be really good technology that is very good at handling edge cases and failure cases on the consumer side. So I think we'll, you know, whether we see MCP as the one and only protocol to win them all, or whether we see a handful of them that persist and eventually shake out, or whether we just see a bunch of like mediocre implementations of different protocols that all, you know, like drop the trailing curly brace on their JSON just
maybe
for fun
the most
every now and
scenario.
Then. You know, well, you know, if the token doesn't get generated for the last curly brace, so
that's
be
right.
It, right?
Exactly.
So I think, you know, it's going to be a push and pull, and ultimately it all comes down to people, or, you know, people in conjunction with AI writing software that can make this stuff usable, right? And so I think we'll see some emergence of coalescence on the consumption side as well, probably. So it'll all be driven by people tolerating, you know, GORPY experiences for only so long, and eventually they'll just
and
want
doing something
to
about it.
Everything is driven by engineers getting real annoyed and going and writing some software.
Yeah. Well, that's all the time we have for today. Gabe, Abraham, Marina, thanks for coming on the show. Always great to have you. Abraham, Gabe, you should come by more often. It's good to see you. And finally, thanks for joining us, listeners. If you enjoyed what you heard, you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and podcast platforms everywhere. And we will see you all next week on Mixture of Experts.